Blog Talk Radio.
Cliff, your host. Earth Ancients is the name of the program. Startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. And I hope you're having a great 4th of July weekend. We're on the second day of a three-day break, at least for me. Yesterday was exciting as usual. Of course, being here in Northern California, every city has their fireworks display. And well into the early wee hours of the morning, people are shooting off all types of fireworks. And so, of course, the animals take a beating with this kind of display. But, hey, we got to celebrate, right? So I hope your weekend is going well. It's beautiful out here today. I know in some parts of the country, East Coast-wise, they're dealing with some flooding, which is unfortunate. Hopefully, actually, I saw some photos, and it looked like even in the rain, people were firing off fireworks and celebrating the holiday. So, I hope everyone's enjoying their weekend. I had a chance to get out. I think I mentioned that I'm going to be in Cusco, Peru later this summer, early fall. I didn't realize that Cusco was at an elevation of 11,000 feet. Now, that is very high, and the air is very thin, and I have it in my head that I need to get some conditioning going. So I went out to Mount Shasta last week, and about a 4.5-hour drive from San Francisco. Got there, and Mount Shasta itself, the city of Mount Shasta, is about 3,000 feet above sea level, but I wanted to get on the trail and hike a little bit, because I think I mentioned I hike 3 or 4 times a week. I'm close to the Oakland Hills, and the elevation there in Oakland Hills is about 1,600 feet above sea level. But Mount Shasta, at its peak, is 10,000 plus. But I didn't climb to the peak, because that would have taken a few days. I wanted to just have a couple of days. So I got up to Mount Shasta City, spent the night. Next morning, got up early, and you drive up Bunny Loop, which is the trailhead, and that's 7,500 feet above sea level. And I had my equipment, camera and scanning and EMF equipment that I wanted to test in a backpack. So I had about 25, 30 pounds of equipment. Hiked up to about 8,000 feet. It was a bit of a struggle for me. But that's good, because I'm not going to be hiking in Cusco. I'm going to be taking photos, and hopefully I'm going to bring a magnetometer with me, which tests the magnetic emissions from stone, from rock, from any kind of structure, and really do some research while I'm there, because that's a fascinating place, which kind of leads me to this week's Facebook. I have, with my associate Jan Peter De Jong, the Dutch engineer, we both have been posting the three phases of Peruvian and Bolivian stone masonry or stoneworks. If you go on the Facebook page now, Earth Ancients, you will see the Hanampacha style, which is the very first style, which is this volcanic-looking stone that they manipulated in such a way to make it look. I mean, it looks like it's man-made, but it's natural stone. So, and then there's a section on vitrification, which is quite fascinating. There's an actual video that you should check out. So the Hanampacha style, and then the second world Pacha, which is what most people recognize as Inca, but it's actually pre-Inca, because masonry is in such a form that it's been machined, and we don't know what kind of machine was done, which kind of machining was used, but the precision of the stone masonry is of such a nature that the only way they could have cut walls that are aligned perfectly, balanced and weighted in such a way that the stones are perfectly aligned, is to have used some form of technology. So the second world, Uran Pacha, is up there. It was posted July 1st. And then just recently, we posted the third and final period, which I think dates from maybe 400 or 500 years ago to when the Spanish arrived, which is Urkin Pacha. And the Urkin Pacha walls are small stones, and they're usually crafted with stone hitting another stone, a harder stone hitting a stone to form it, to shape it. And in some cases, a mallet and a chisel were used to chisel away stone surfaces so that they would fit uniformly. The final phase is the most crude of the phases, but I urge you to take a look at that. Because those three phases are interesting. The first phase, which is the most dramatic, Hanampacha, is estimated to be mid-Pleistocene, which should be 100,000 plus years ago, up until about 50,000 years ago. That's the earliest period. It's estimated. We still don't know, but it's the guesstimate of Alfredo Gramara, who was the early explorer, research scientist that was working on that. So take a look. Do take a look. The other thing I want to mention is on the Atacama Desert region of Peru, a whole new type of humanoid has been discovered, human beings with immensely large heads. And these people are so unusual. I've been able to post one photograph. They are correspond quite. They could be similar or related to the Paracas people, who I have posted many times on the Facebook page. But if you take a look at the photo of this one individual, he's a mummified individual. His head is so extremely long that there's just no way that could have been a head-bound individual. He looks like his head's twice as large as a normal head. So have a look at that and see what you think, and you can read some of the descriptions, what they have uncovered. It's a new series of archaeological digs supported by the University of Poland. The Atacama Desert is home to these people, and I guess they uncovered 150 mummies, which is quite a lot. So it seems like it's a graveyard. The other area that is a big interest of mine is ancient America. I have posted a number of photos from author Barry Fell, who wrote a fascinating book called America BC. I really suggest, if you're interested in early America, prior to the native people that we consider the oldest and original people, actually there is earlier settlers that are thousands and thousands of years older than the Native Americans that we consider the first people. But Barry Fell did a tremendous amount of research and study in the 1960s and into the 1970s, I'm going to continue to post some of his work on the Facebook page. But I'm actually so interested in it that I our guest today is a proponent of ancient America. So we'll talk a little about him in a second. So take a look at the website, Facebook page, Earth Ancients, and take a look at the Minotauls, which are these standing stones with a central aperture, a large cut hole in them, and take a look at some of the readings. The next phase of research in these ancient megaliths, monoliths, by the way, megaliths are man-made, monoliths are natural. So when you hear the word monolith, that is a naturally occurring structure. A megalith has some man-made features. Either they've cut holes into a standing stone or they've carved into it in some form and then put it up and stood it either on a energy field, which is emerging up and through the ground, or in such a way that it is magnifying its own magnetic field, which is produced through energy flow from the natural occurring Earth energy. So those are things to talk about, things to discuss, things that I'm very interested in. And I think you'll be interested in it too. So my guest today is Brandon Hurd. Brandon has written a fascinating book called Ancient Mississippi, and the subtitle is Evidence of a Lost Civilization Uncovered, America's Oldest Secrets Unveiled. And Brandon is a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army and a veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq. He served there. He has a master's degree in psychology as well as a B.S. degree in management. And he has researched and reported on numerous locations throughout the Southwest and Southeast. This is his first book, Ancient Mississippi. He is an instructor at the U.S. Army's Command and General Staff Officer School, as well as a vocational instructor. And we're going to bring him on right now. Hi, Brandon, are you there?
Yes, Cliff.
Hi.
Can you hear me? Hey, Cliff.
Yeah, we can hear you. Perfect.
Good.
So tell us a little bit about this book. Now, I guess you've been involved and interested in researching on your own for quite a bit, but what was the specific interest in the ancient people of Mississippi? Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I probably should start at the beginning of kind of how I fell down this rabbit hole that I haven't really been able to get out of. I had just finished another story for a local magazine about another site in Mississippi, another mysterious location, the Devil's Punch Bowl in Natchez. And that had gone real well, and I was trying to top that. So, and I like to write about things that are mysterious places, mysterious people, mysterious things. So I Googled the term mysterious Mississippi, and the third thing that came up was a story from the New York Times in 1900 describing a incredible stone structure in a remote part of Mississippi. And it was referred to as the Brandywine Stone Wall. And it was the article went on to suggest that it was it was built by an unknown ancient civilization. And I was fascinated by that, and I had never really heard of it, so I began to do some research. I went out to the area and knocked on doors for a few days, but with no luck until I finally came across one elderly lady who said, well, there's this hermit that used to live down this road, and he used to talk about some odd stones. So I went out to that property, and when I pulled in the driveway, I was kind of blown away because the property was covered up with large cut stones that matched the description from the story from 1900. And all throughout the area, there was no other stones bigger than a pebble. You know, I couldn't. It was a flooded area. It's been covered up times since the early 1900s. And so So I came across this property, and real quick, I realized I was kind of in over my head because I started noticing some, there were some odd things there. There were stones that had obviously been, had kind of been worked by man, and there was, so I contacted another local researcher that's in a similar vein, Dr. Robert List. And he and I have been working together for about the past year or so, developing site. It is, we refer to it as the Brandywine Stonewall site. And
okay.
Some of the key things about the place that it's kind of odd. It's, you know, we've come across some very bizarre artifacts out of this thing. It's, well, there's a stone structure. And I would, real quick here, I want to refer your listeners to my Facebook group, Ancient Mississippi. That's where I put a lot of the pictures that will kind of help you kind of digest the information or at my
okay.
Facebook page. And so we've had some, there were some stone carvings. There's a stone head, the one that's on your advertisement, that's one of the stone heads that came out of the site, and two other stone, one's like an owl, and the other one is another bizarre-looking head. There's also a 9-foot-long snake.
A stone snake?
Other,
is it
yes,
stone, the snake?
Long.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
And it has, the stone snake has the top of it, has been carved and polished. At one time it was polished. It's got a very ancient patina, but it's weathered now, but at one time it was polished and worked flat, and it has a very peculiar bowl carved into it, or a semi-bowl. So, you know, we don't know if this was an altar or what, but... and some other artifacts that came out of the site suggest that at least at one time it was occupied by an ancient Native American civilization that was in the area, the Poverty Point culture, which that's a whole other story in it. Are you familiar with the Poverty Point culture?
You know, I've read a little bit about them, and I know you mentioned about that area in your book, but no, I haven't done a great deal of research on it, and that's why your book's fascinating. So hey, but I know I wanna really get into your focal point, which is Mississippi, and focus on the book. And I want you to tell us, because what you've discovered is amazing. Who were the first Mississippians? That's what I want to hear about, because that's amazing.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
That's kind of a different story. I'm gonna. That's sort of a different angle that I'm gonna take. And you know what I've done in the book is I came across the oldest known man-made artifacts that I'm aware of are some Clovis points that were found in the northern part of the state. And you know what is now coming out is that we were all taught in school that the Clovis people, the Native Americans, they only came over the Bering land bridge, and the dates, since I was a kid, have changed by about 10,000 years. But there was only one way to North America. Well, a very, very strong case is emerging that in fact, the first humans in Mississippi, in North America, including Mississippi, came from Europe. During the Ice Age, when the water levels were much lower, and this is based on the stone tools, the very distinct stone making technology that they used. Yeah, and the trail only goes one way; it goes east up through Greenland. And back over directly, it connects direct. The stone tool technology connects directly to Europe, France specifically. It's called the Solutrean hypothesis, and the Solutreans were known for their very interesting cave art that they produced. But Now, if you go up the West Coast, up to Alaska, there are instances of this stone technology, this Clovis style of workmanship, but it goes cold. That trail, they have a completely different technology. Once you get west of Alaska, that trail goes cold. So that's very, and there's some researchers with the Smithsonian now who are throwing out a date of 25,000 BC for the
right
initial.
Now this is what the interesting thing about what you've just described is the Salute trains are known in Europe. They're well known as a Paleolithic people that lived between 22,000 and 17,000 BC, and they're unique because their tools are sophisticated. Now, what you reveal in the parts of Mississippi that you discover are similar types of tool making, and so your hypothesis is that the Salute trains got all the way into that part of our country, of the United States, and set up camp. Is that what you're saying in your book?
Yes.
Okay.
And then, you know, it appears that there was some kind of an event that where those people, the people of European lineage, their presence began to falter, okay. One of the theories is there were severe cometary events throughout the East Coast and the Eastern United States, which was apparently where they were predominantly at. I mean, they found human remains with cometary fragments in them, and also with animal remains. And this is about the same time that the megafauna, the mastodon, the larger animals disappeared. Was about this time of these where the Clovis, where the Salutrian descendants began to dissipate.
Right,
and it's hypothesized that they were, you know, perhaps killed off, or the vestiges of them were assimilated into the more Asian, the descendants of the Asian migrants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what you're describing is the well-known catastrophic event that was a worldwide event approximately 9,500 BC, which would be 12,000 years ago, and the soul trains that were in that Mississippi area that you described were significantly dissipated, or a lot of them were killed off in that event. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
That's what I'm saying. There's evidence on the ground in the form. We call them Grady ponds in Mississippi. And they're what they are is they're like swamps, different other depressions in the ground that are the remains the impacts of ancient cometary strikes. But we call them Grady ponds.
Okay.
I think in along the East Coast they call it the Carolina Bays, if you'd like to Google that term. But they're all over, you know, the southeast and the eastern U.S., these Carolina Bays that are just massive cometary craters.
Right. Now, did you actually locate some skeletal remains of the people that lived in this Poverty Point area that have fragments of asteroids and meteorites, the meteorite hit?
No.
Because I've been curious about that.
And what we're kind of jumping ahead a little bit to the Poverty Point culture, which, you know, they began their ascent as a emerging civilization about 2400 BC, and their civilization lasted until about 1000 BC. And they're referred to as the Poverty Point culture, but there's one main Poverty Point site, and it was just recognized as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it's in Epps, Louisiana. And it's a fascinating series of earthworks that are For one thing, they're massive. And the design, the mathematics and the astronomical alignments are just kind of hard to understand how a civilization who, you know, began to rise at, you know, 2400 BC, 2000 BC, how they were building these very mathematically advanced earthworks. So that's one of the strange. Now, a suggestion, and what, you know, there certainly appears to be evidence that there was a, that this is one of the places where there was, it was a hotbed of trade and commerce, and it supported an ancient global copper trade. There's a lot of unusual copper evidence at the Poverty Point location. And, you know, it's theorized that it was a place where either a trading hub or that it was, in fact, a melting location for the copper that was mined from Michigan, from Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And that's accepted archaeology that there were these ancient copper mines in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan back dating to about 3000 BC. And where the kind of the mystery is, you know, it's there's massive amounts of copper that were mined. Okay, and this is during the Bronze Age in Europe, and just massive amounts of copper were removed from this, and it's accepted archaeology. But, you know, when you begin to look at Native American sites, yeah, I mean, there are Native American, certainly, copper artifacts, but just really nothing, it doesn't equal out. You know, there was the massive tonnage that was removed from Michigan does not equal nearly to what kind of has begun to emerge from Native American sites. So it is an existing theory. It's been out there for a long time that there was that copper from Michigan was used to fuel, to source the copper demands of Europe circa, you know, 2500 BC to perhaps up to 1200 BC.
And so to get it to Europe, did they have a shipping line or some kind of that you've detected that would bring it back to Europe?
Well, and that kind of brings it back to my story, the story of Mississippi. And this is really kind of another way that I began to got into this theory. But the theory was that it was the Minoan civilization who were known. They have a shipping and a sailing tradition that went back perhaps thousands of years before their civilization eventually faltered. But their sailing tradition, you know, they've got frescoes that they've unearthed there of multi-masted ships. You know, large ships, and they have found sunken ships. There's a shipwreck that was found off the coast of Turkey that it had trade goods in it from, I believe, 8 continents. And that shipwreck dated to about 1500 BC. Okay, and it also included of these copper oxides, which is a shape of I believe it's about a 60-pound block of copper. It was just a shape for uniform trading. They found large quantity of these copper oxides in the shipwreck. And the characteristics of these copper oxides match the Michigan copper.
Oh, you mean chemically? They're able to determine that they came from the United States, these blocks?
Well, it's a disputed, there's dispute here. This is an area of, you know, one PhD says one thing, another PhD says the exact opposite. So, but this is an area, a point of contention. And it's difficult to obtain, they've studied the ingots. And, you know, one group says that they do display the characteristics of North American copper. Other groups say no, that they're from the mines of Cyprus or over there. But where that story ties in to Mississippi is there's a YouTube video. It's a presentation by Jay Wakefield that originally kind of drew me into this theory. And he described there's some anomalous archaeological sites on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. They're called Cedarland and Claypool. And they display, they're Poverty Point culture sites. They display Poverty Point culture artifacts. But they also, they have other characteristics. You know, the archaeologists report suggests these people spoke a different language and that they were foreigners to the area. And these sites contain vast, like 100 meter long, 6 foot deep hearths and, filled with charcoal. And there's also just all these clay artifacts that they find there that don't have any particular, they're just broken up pieces of clay. Well, it's hypothesized that this was the world's factory for copper, perhaps 2000 to 1500 BC. And so they were taking the copper down the Mississippi River over to these, and it's the first high ground. It's a deep water port on the coast, and they would take the copper from Michigan to the Mississippi Gulf Coast, where it would be melted into these forms and then put on larger boats for onward shipment to the markets of Europe or Egypt.
Well, let me ask you a question. If they're smelting copper in Mississippi, is there evidence of these kilns or smelting equipment? I mean, we're talking what, 2000 BC that this was going on?
Roughly, yes. Okay. The evidence of the site for that is the massive hearth complex, okay, at these two sites that are side by side.
You mean Cedarland and Claybourne, right?
Cedarland and Claybourne. And okay. And the broken up pieces of clay that appear to have no other use. They're just broken pieces of clay. And it's theorized that these were the molds. Now, that's what kind of captured my imagination, that theory and that information. And then I came across another little tidbit from involving some unusual stones. Well, let me back up a little bit. Another part of that theory was that these ancient mariners were going up, that those two sites are at the mouth of the Pearl River. As part of that theory, they would have sailed up the Pearl River to get fresh water, to get firewood, to get other trade goods, whatever. But part of the theory was that they were sailing up the Pearl River. And that's where my research comes into play.
Okay.
Up the Pearl River, I've located just a bizarre series of artifacts. It's these four stones that are identical in shape and size to stone anchors of that era that were used in Mediterranean ships. And they're on the ground, and they're very in close proximity to the Pearl River. And one of these stone anchors has a tablet carved into it, which is kind of interesting because it was a distinct the border of the tablet matches other Minoan tablets that are known to exist. So
okay.
Apparently that was the style of artwork that they used. And in studying these stones, Dr. List and myself, we would sit over these things for just hours looking at this stone tablet, and it was so it was worn, and it was the color of the stone. It was hard for the eye to detect all of the images. I mean, there's some very distinct images. We just had difficulty finding out what they were. And then eventually, just through good fortune, we encountered an artist who was interested in them as well. And we brought her in and let her spend some time photographing and studying the stones. And she generated a drawing that depicts, and what I think is what in fact is in the stone. It's a pencil on white with a white background, and it's just a lot easier for the brain to see what the images are. And probably the most distinct image on it is an Egyptian style bird hieroglyph, and that is distinct in the stone. I mean, I would, that is to me, and I've seen it. It's there. Okay, the bird hieroglyph is there. There's also other images that are faded, and there's the image of what appears to be a boat, the style of ship that would have been from that era of the Mediterranean. And there's another image that has a Minoan style axe, in addition to some other kind of lines and other features in it. But there's some very distinct images that just with the help of an artist have begun to emerge from the stone. And those pictures are on my Facebook page, the Ancient Mississippi page.
We'll have to make sure we post that. Let me ask you about the Cedarland and Claiborne area. Did they build harbors, or did they use a natural harbor to anchor their ships there? Is that why there's so many of those anchors there? Is that what the theory is behind those anchors?
Yeah, well, the anchors are up the Pearl River, but they're not there at the Cedarland and Claiborne sites. They're further north up the Pearl River.
Okay, so how far is that from?
It's a natural deep water port because it's the mouth of a large river. So it's got a deep channel that a ship could navigate up in.
Okay. So the Pearl River has these anchors, and have they found, when you say anchors, what are these stones with these massive holes cut in them? What do they weigh? What kind of weight are we talking about?
We haven't put a scale to them because we're scared that we may break them or something. But I'm about 350 pounds each.
Oh, so they're very heavy.
Very heavy, yeah. And which matches the size and approximate weight of other stone anchors that have been recovered from other Minoan shipwrecks.
I'd love to see some photos of that, Brandon. Is that on that Facebook page that we can put up, the comparison of the Minoan and the Mississippian? Okay, great.
Yeah, I've got a drawing that was done by an archaeologist from Israel of stone anchors that were found off the coast of Israel. And they match identically. It's an identical match. And the stone anchors that are on the site on the Pearl River, they kind of all have a uniform same size hole, 5-inch hole. It's kind of interesting that it's all uniform. And one of the stone anchors has a notch in it that kind of radiates from the hole to the edge of the anchor. And it's really odd that in that little groove that it has another 1-inch hole drilled through it that I understand was a characteristic of an Egyptian stone anchor. They would have tied like a guide rope to it to pull it up against the boat or to secure it. But it was another hole. So another alternate kind of hypothesis is that this was an Egyptian visitation, or an Egyptian enterprise.
Okay.
And that's kind of ties back to the Brandywine Wall site with some very, I guess, anomalous, there's what appears to be a rather large hearth, and all along this hearth, and just there, using a metal detector, you know, we've detected just for about 10 meters out and about 30 meters the length of this structure, buried iron, or perhaps buried iron ore, or perhaps the residue of they had an iron bog iron, if you will, manufacturing site.
Interesting. The book Ancient Mississippi, Evidence of Lost Civilizations Uncovered, America's Oldest Secrets, Secret Revealed, tell us about Robert List, Dr. Robert List. Now, was he already researching the area and you guys just kind of connected, collaborated? What was his interest? Has he written a book on any of the material that you're covering?
He's a frequent contributor to Ancient American Magazine. He's written several articles about Poverty Point. And that's how I encounter him. And then since subsequent to that, he has produced articles for Ancient American Magazine about these sites in Mississippi that he and I have worked on together.
Very good. Okay. Fascinating. What is the... So if it was 2000 BC, that's roughly 5,000 years ago, what is the culture that you have determined? Or what is this idea behind the culture? Was it just Europeans coming up and not out to America and not really staying? Or is it a hybrid of the Soltran Clovis people who somehow connected with Europeans via Atlantic shipping lanes of some kind? Who are the people?
The people were a group of Native Americans with a emerging civilization, okay? And what I think helped bring that civilization about was commerce and interaction with Mediterranean cultures, Minoans and perhaps Egyptians, trading up and down the Mississippi. And at this site in Louisiana, which it does display some characteristics that are signatures of an Egyptian presence. The design itself, the concentric circles, I think it's, some people refer to that as an Atlantean design. Right now the site is like a giant sea. But, there's dispute over whether it's a sea shaper or in ancient times that this wasn't a complete circle. And the evidence strongly suggests that, yes, in fact, it was a complete circle. It's actually a series of concentric circles. And it's a very impressive earthwork there.
Is there any, did these people build mounds? Is there any mounds around there?
Yes.
They were mound builders. Interesting. Okay.
Yes. They have a series of mounds. The most impressive of which is referred to as the Bird Mound. And it's there at the Poverty Point site in Epps, Louisiana. And it's just a massive bird shaped structure.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
It's on this bird-shaped mound on Poverty Point. Can you give me approximate dimensions of this and how high it is, this mound?
It's a very large mound. It's I believe, and I'm just kind of drawing on memory here, it's 65 feet high now. So, you know, it's probably higher than that, you know, in ancient times. But what they've done recently, I'll give it to them, they've done a really good job of just a few years ago, it was covered up in trees that were, you know, it made it hard to really see what it was. And it was, you know, the trees were kind of breaking it down. So they've, the curators at Poverty Point have done a really good job of kind of bringing it back to a lot closer to what it was originally.
Okay.
And preserving it.
Has anyone gone in and done an excavation to see if there's a grave or any rooms within these mounds? A lot of times, from what I understand, some of these mounds were sanctuaries.
The site itself, Poverty Point, it really only came about, became known in the early, I'd say the 30s, is when it was first discovered. It was discovered through aerial, like prop dusters or, you know, somebody saw it from an airplane. And
right.
And so it's there's been a lot of research done there, but only a small fraction. I mean, the figure that I've heard is 0.5% of the site has been excavated. So there's a lot of work to be done there. And it's gonna reveal, it's got a lot to reveal.
Well, let's talk about that just for yeah, go ahead.
I will tell you one of the types of artifacts that the site is known for, and that other Poverty Point sites are known for, are these they're called plummets, and they look like a plumb bob on a survey, you know, device, kind of a weight. But the ones in the museum at Poverty Point, they look like they were made on a precision metal lathe. I mean, these things are just precision crafted to include a hole in the handle of them, you know, the researchers at Poverty Point suggest that these are fishing net weights. Yet they have just, you know, intricate designs carved into them, and they're just beautiful to behold. I mean, there's amazing artifacts just to look at, not to mention the artwork. And some of the imagery that's found at Poverty Point is, you know, Minoan imagery. I mean, they've got one of their symbols that keeps turning up on these plummets are beehive symbols, the symbol of a beehive, which was a distinctly iconic Minoan design.
I guess my big question is, have they found any burial grounds where some of these people could be excavated so that we could determine they were, of a Northern European racial type?
Well, at Poverty Point, I don't think there's any dispute that they were Native Americans. Now, the Poverty Point culture people were Native Americans of predominantly Asian descent. Those were the Poverty Point people. They were, hunter-gatherer types. They came together there at Poverty Point and the other Poverty Point site, and they had, you know, they displayed government. They had a trade network that spanned 1,400 miles. Mm. You know, they find the types of obviously copper artifacts there that came from Michigan. That's the only place they could have come from. And they also have different types of stone and exotic stones that come from I believe Montana. You know, there's the only place that those stones are is in Montana and other far flung places throughout the east, you know, northwest,
okay,
Michigan. So they had a vast you know, this burgeoning, emerging civilization displayed, you know, some very advanced traits. Not to mention their craftsmanship and their artifacts that they left behind. They, and it's kind of enigmatic as to what the use of some of them are. I mean, it's kind of a, it's just a lot of theory as to what these, some of the artifacts were used for.
You know, it's interesting, the amount of artifacts and physical remains are so plentiful. It's interesting that more mainstream archaeologists and anthropologists haven't included more of this in, like, you don't read about it in National Geographic, or maybe you do. Has there been anything reported by the Smithsonian or the National Geographic?
And, you know, I'm not aware of the Smithsonian per se, but there, it's been in the media just especially recently with their achieving UNESCO World Heritage Site status. So it's been in the media, and it's, you know, but it's very much understudied. I mean, there's a lot of work there for researchers and archaeologists for years to come.
Okay. Wow. The book is Ancient Mississippi. If you would like to join my guest, Brandon Hurd, you're welcome to call in at 347-826-9565 and just press number one, and we'll call on you. And you can ask Brandon a question that you might have. I want to move a little forward here. Your book touches upon subjects that I'm extremely interested in, which is Mesoamerican culture, primarily the Maya. And in your book, you show the Issaquena disc, which I guess was discovered in Mississippi. Can you tell us a little bit about this disc and what makes it so unique? I just saw a picture of it, and I have posted it, and it is quite unique.
Yeah, it definitely is. Actually, it's kind of this artifact itself is compelling evidence of a Mesoamerican Mayan presence, not just in Mississippi, but in Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Okay, there are two other stone discs that match, not the front of this, of the Issaquena disc, but the backs. The backs match and the edges match. They refer to as scalloped. The edges are scalloped, or they have a shape to them. And the reverse side is basically blank. But the reverse sides of these three discs that were found, one of them was found in the North Georgia. Another one was found in Moundsville, Alabama. And the third one, the Issaquena disc, was found in a mound in Mississippi. So these discs are indisputably related, okay? And it's theorized that these discs were possibly symbols of a peace treaty. But the imagery on the front of the Issaquena disc I've had it colorized. I've had it kind of enhanced by an artist to bring out the obvious features. And it's two flying serpents, which is Quetzalcoatl imagery, which is, you know, I mean, the flying serpent imagery is, you know, throughout the Americas, but predominantly, distinctly, that type is emerges from Mesoamerica. And before the academics became involved, and the early researchers who looked at the Issaquena disc and the imagery, they identified it as one of these deals. It's like six of one, half dozen of the other, but they labeled it as Toltec imagery, which and that's not the only imagery that is distinctly Mayan from an artifact that's been found in Mississippi. There's also some copper plate. Other copper plates have been found, once again in Georgia, that display distinctly Minoan, you know, the same motif of a warrior carrying a severed head, with the same style headdress as is depicted on Mayan imagery in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Yet this is a copper plate that's found in Georgia.
What is the date given to those, Brandon? What's the date on for that?
The date of, and you got to think too, it's the level that artifact came from, that mound, as I recall, it was 700 A.D. is what, and when you get into dating, you know, these mounds, it's just, especially back in the era when this thing was first studied and it was first dated, you know, it's a guess, you know,
okay.
And so it's kind of hard to really pin it down, but that date of 700 A.D. isn't in conflict with the theory of a mind presence throughout the Southeast United States. And there's a case of in Georgia that's compelling. You know, they've done a lot of research over there where the Mayan connection from Georgia is, you know, almost undeniable. It's obvious.
Okay, that's fascinating. And so you're saying there's other examples of the Essequina disc in other states in the South, similar in style.
They're similar in style, but the imagery is a different image on the front. For example, the one the disc that was found in Moundsville, Louisiana. That image is of a hand with an eye in the hand. You know, is that the, once again, that, you know, it's almost Mediterranean style imagery there, with the Eye of Ra. Mm-hmm. But that imagery used to be referred to as the Southern Death Cult, is what that theme of imagery was. That's what they used to refer to it, but now that things are kind of more politically correct, I think they call it the Moundsville culture is what they refer to it now as.
Okay. Wow. Here's a question from on Facebook from John, and John's writing to us from North Carolina. He wants to know where he can go see these artifacts. What museums, he says, are there any museums where I can see these artifacts? ?
Yes. You can see the pictures of most of the things that I describe are at my Facebook member group, Ancient Mississippi. So, and I kind of, they're listed there. You may have to dig a little bit, but they're there. The stone anchors, they're there at the top. They should be in the Brandywine stone wall. Some of those artifacts I've kind of updated recently, and they're up towards the top, but as far as the Mayan stuff, the Issaquena stone disc, you may have to dig a little bit, but it's there. Now, oddly enough, the Issaquena disc, at first it was looking like that artifact, that's the kind of thing that the conventional archaeologist, it's a problem for them, so they don't like it, okay? So things disappear, you know? Things are just put in drawers and hidden away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that artifact, I did luckily kind of track it down to a museum in Ohio. And off the top of my head, I don't recall the name of the museum, but it is at a museum in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an artifact that really should be in Mississippi. I mean, it should be on display in a museum in Mississippi. So
they want their artifacts. Of course, it might even be considered an anomalous artifact, and so, you know, academic archaeologists may want to stay, like you say, steer clear of that because it kind of throws a wrench in conventional history. How do you feel, Brandon, about that? Let's talk about that for a minute. How do you feel about the historical references to America. I mean, obviously, yeah. Your research must really, you know, make one wonder what the how the description has been.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, the reality of the ancient world in North America was far different than is depicted in history books and in movies. You know, and as further evidence of that, I would suggest that, you know, I went and found the earliest accounts of first contact with the Native Americans, and that was De Soto's expedition. And De Soto's historian describes a civilization vastly different than is described in history books. You know, he describes, you know, that they wore certainly linen clothing, that they had houses with furniture that were covered in linen that was decorated linen. They had tapestries hanging on their walls. They had they used standards of war in battle. They had dogs. They had houses with walls around them, and they said that they had farms and fields that were regularly surveyed. And that's another big misconception that has just recently come out, is the idea that the European settlers cleared the trees from North America. Now, the trees were already, that's becoming accepted, that the 25,000 plus years of habitation in North America, that those people cleared off the trees in the open areas of North America. That's just now kind of becoming accepted. You know, so the idea that it was the British and the French and the Dutch farmers that were making these massive fields, that's erroneous.
Mm-hmm.
Now I got another little real world situation. The picture of that stone head that was on the ad.
Mm-hmm.
I sent that picture along with some other photographs to a state archaeologist, and within seconds he replied that was obviously formed by natural erosion, despite me describing the other archaeologists. And yeah, if you look at this, I mean, it has, you know, obviously the shape and the facial features are distinctly man-made. If you were to examine it, it's indisputable. As a matter of fact, I took it to Poverty Point and let their
research. I think we lost you there for a second. You're not coming through. Brandon, we're not catching you there. I don't know. We're having some difficulties hearing you.
And his argument was that, well, it had been proven that the Brandywine stone wall site was a natural feature.
Okay, I don't know if he can hear me or not. Obviously, we're having some technical difficulties here. Hi, Brandon? Well, I apologize. It seems like he is on a line that we cannot hear. Brandon, can you hear me? Let me try something here. I apologize. I don't know. He is calling from New Jersey, and we're having some problems here listening. Hi, Brandon. Can you hear me?
Okay. Hey, I'm back.
Oh, there you are. We lost you for about a couple of minutes there.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what's going on.
And I was just rolling on, too.
You were rolling, and we missed all this vital data, my friend. Well, I just posted your Facebook page onto my Facebook page, and I'll also publish it on the on this radio blog so people can read about it. We just got a few more minutes, and I want you to give our audience an idea of what your future endeavors are related to this book, Ancient Mississippi, and what's really up and coming for you. Because I think you mentioned you're in current research on some other relics you had found. So why don't you tell us a little bit about those things?
Well, recently I set up this Facebook member group called Ancient Mississippi. And since I established that has proven to be an invaluable source of new leads and new artifacts and new perspectives. And there's a lot of, discussion. These things are, it's a forum for discussion. And it's a lot of good leads are coming out of that. And this creating some more, some more writing opportunities, certainly. But, and it's the kind of the route that's going is more of the, just kind of, I don't know why, but it's the different waves of migration that came to the Americas before Columbus. For example, one of the big artifacts that we talk about on the site that's gotten a lot of attention is the Bat Creek Stone. And this is a stone that was discovered in the 1870s at a Smithsonian dig. And it was this stone. It was originally classified as having some form of Cherokee writing on it, and it was just filed away into a box. Well, 60 years later, a researcher who was examining a connection and a theory that there was a connection between a Hebrew migration and the Cherokee. She found this artifact in a drawer and turned it upside down. And when it was turned upside down, the characters on it are clearly a proto-Hebrew, an early form of Hebrew writing. And once it was translated, I believe it says for Judea. So and there's all several different accounts or historical events that would have precipitated an exodus of Jews from the Middle East, such as the first, the diaspora, which was, I believe, I'm just kind of thinking that was 700 B.C., the Lost Tribes. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, that was one possible migration. And then I believe when the Assyrians attacked the area that's now Israel in Jerusalem in, I believe, 100 A.D., and they killed 500,000 Jews, that would have been another good precipitator to a voyage to somewhere, a voyage, a refugee situation, and there's biblical accounts of advanced shipping capability. The I think it's in Barry Fell's book. He talks about the biblical references to ships and King Solomon's shipping fleet.
Fell's book is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Like I said, he was onto something, and it's an area. This idea, it's generally referred to as diffusionism, which is the idea that ancient civilizations traveled far more extensively and shared ideas to a much larger degree than history gives them credit for.
Right. Exactly.
So that's that field. And, you know, this field is just it's just very understudied, you know, and it's one reason is academics are hesitant to engage in it, you know.
Well, it changes the look of the whole world if they start admitting that Minoans were smelting copper and bringing it back to Europe, and Egyptians were visiting, and it's like it throws a wrench in their whole theory. And of course, then they have to start considering rewriting history. And I think that is the biggest. There's going to have to be a whole new group of archaeologists, anthropologists, historians that want to tackle that and really step out of into the light. So,
yeah. Another key piece of evidence is there's a all across. It's primarily in the southeast United States. They find in Indian mounds and in the ground, they find coins that date to second and third century from the Mediterranean area. So they find these coins. They've been the number that sticks in my head is about 9 of them at different sites. That it's kind of hard to explain how they got here. There's actually one that I include in the book that was found in Mississippi, and it was actually found close to a Poverty Point culture site. So somebody
Fantastic.
Was coming over here. Somebody was coming over here.
Wow.
And leaving breadcrumbs.
Well, I personally appreciate your research. I think our listeners should definitely get this book. I've posted it on Facebook, and it's called Ancient Mississippi, Evidence of Lost Civilization Uncovered, America's Oldest Secret Revealed. And our guest today has been Brandon Hurd. And it's an e-book. And is it available anywhere else other than Amazon? I think, is that the only place
no,
you have it right now?
Just on Amazon.
Okay, perfect. And it's easy to download. If you don't have a Kindle player, you can use one of a 3 or 4 free Kindle players that will you can play on, so you don't have to go out and spend extra money for a Kindle player. And it is a fantastic book. So we'll look forward to hearing more from you, Brandon. I have posted your Facebook page on my Facebook page, and I'll also post that on our radio blog. And wonderful work. Fantastic. I want to thank you for joining us today. And we'll continue to follow you and your research as it expands. I would imagine that you have some more books in store for us.
Yeah, it's definitely enough material for a volume 2. And like I said, this, you know, there's just the way things came about, came together for this story and for all these articles, the coincidences are mind-blowing to me. The way, for example, the stone anchors. Well, the way I found that involved me on the phone to a lady that I just happened to know, and she just happened to know. She was in her mid-70s. She has an iPad. She has Google Earth on her iPad, and I have Google Earth on my laptop, and she's walking me in to the exact location of where these stone anchors were at. And I just happened to know this lady, you know? I mean, it's a miracle. Another big, somebody whose name I have to throw out, is Gavin Menzies. He wrote what I think is probably the best case of the Minoan global copper trade story. He wrote with Gavin Menzies, and how I came across him, the name Garrett Menzies popped into my head in a dream at like 2 a.m, and I emailed it to myself.
Wow.
And when I pulled it, I Googled it. Well, he had written a book on this Minoan theory, you know? And I was like, well, that's exactly mm-hmm. what I was running down, yeah?
Well, it seems like most of the new and wonderful discoveries are coming from non-academics, and you have become one of these historic revivalists. That's what I'll call it, a revivalist.
Okay.
So there you go. Which is great. Well, listen, thanks again, and I'll be in touch with you. Our show's done for the day. It's done. And as a reminder, next week, tune in. My guest will be Nick Redfern, who has written a book called The Pyramids and the Pentagon, The Government's Top Secret Pursuit of Mystical Relics, Ancient Astronauts, and Lost Civilization. Nick's quite a prolific writer. He's written over 20 books. He's got another book coming out pretty soon. So that's it for today's show. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, what's remaining of it, and stay tuned for next program. Also, as always, check our Facebook page, Earth Ancients on Facebook, and keep abreast of all the latest on ancient civilizations. Have a great